humanizing of Muslims followed years of scapegoating in order to rationalize the wars across the Muslim world started by Trump's predecessors, George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Perhaps above all, the ban showed that in the American system, it is still possible to codify racism into law. The Supreme Court reversed a series of lower court decisions which allowed the ban to go into effect. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Slim hopes of progress towards peace in Yemen were swiftly dashed this month as former US President Donald Trump designated Yemen's Houthi Ansarullah movement as a foreign terrorist organization before he left office. A move widely condemned as deeply damaging to the peace process and pushing the country towards a possible new famine. Amid fears for Yemen's future, I secured an exclusive interview with the foreign minister of the Ansarullah-led government in Sana'a for a response to these disturbing developments.
The US is not an international organization or some kind of an institution that has the right to designate someone as terrorist or not terrorist. The US should always be concerned about its affairs, not trying to be the guardian of the whole world.
The foreign minister explained that he felt the US decision was silly and that Trump was probably paid into making the choice.
I think the Trump administration decision was something paid for. And you will see it in the near future. It's something paid for to say certain things or to take some actions. So again, from our side, we are not concerned about that and we will not deal with it.
I asked the foreign minister whether Yemen would consider a military response. He warned that if the peace process totally fails, Yemen is strong enough to fight back.
If such peace fails, we are ready for all circumstances, and our choices are wide open. And by the way, we can affect and do what we want. We are so strong to the point that we can change the whole scenario, but we will not do it for the sake of the Yemeni people.
The foreign minister also sent a message to the new US President Joe Biden.
If Biden has the courage, and I think he does, they should make an announcement that this war is over. They stop the support of the Saudis and the Emiratis and any other people involved, and the war will stop. And Mr. Biden, maybe later on, will get the Nobel Prize that Trump was running after. Now Biden should run after it.
It's been reported that Biden's foreign policy team disagrees with the terror designation and that many of Trump's policies will be reversed in quick succession. But even if the US ends its support for the Saudi coalition's aggression, peace may be unachievable so long as the Ansarullah-held areas are sanctioned. Robert Carter, London.
French President Emmanuel Macron has ruled out issuing an official apology for the atrocities committed by French troops in Algeria. In a statement, Macron's office said there will be no repentance or apologies for the occupation of Algeria or the deadly eight-year war that ended 132 years of French rule in the North African country. Algeria has been demanding a formal apology for years for France's colonial-era war crimes. The French presidency, however, said France will instead endeavor to face up to its history. The statement comes ahead of the publication of a major government commission report on how France has dealt with its colonial past in the North African country. The report offers proposal to address long-standing grievances, but it skirts the issue of systematic torture by French troops and does not recommend an official apology. France occupied Algeria in 1830. The African country gained independence following the Algerian War of 1954 to 1962. The war is also known as the Algerian Revolution. Algerian historians put the death toll at 1.5 million Algerian victims, while the French historians say around 400,000 people from both sides were killed in the conflict. The truth of the colonization and the War of Independence lay buried for decades. During his presidential campaign in 2017, Macron called the colonization of Algeria a crime against humanity. In September 2018, he officially acknowledged for the first time the widespread use of torture by French forces in the former colony. However, like his predecessors, Macron has so far refrained from issuing a formal apology for his country's colonial past. But grievances tied to the colonial history have weighed on French national integration, since many French citizens are Muslims of Algerian descent. As former Foreign Minister Bernard Kouchner admitted in 2008, there seems to be a permanent contradiction between human rights and the foreign policy of France. The country's dark history of human rights violations and supporting dictators, especially in Africa and West Asia, serves as proof of Kouchner's remark that the French foreign policy is not based on human rights. France's support for former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein during his invasion of Iran in the 1980s, its support for Libya's longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi before his ouster in 2011, and the country's arms sales to Saudi Arabia while the kingdom is involved in the brutal war on Yemen are all indicative of such a policy. It so appears that human rights is only a weapon in the hands of French politicians to target nations that do not get along with their policies.
Democrat Joe Biden has been inaugurated as President of the United States, replacing the highly controversial Donald Trump. As a result of entrenched but minority perceptions of electoral fraud, there was not a peaceful transfer of power. The nation's capital was locked down into a fortress with more soldiers than the U.S. uses to occupy both Afghanistan and Iraq. State capitals were similarly swarming with troops nationwide. The inauguration is being called a merciful conclusion to an electoral campaign which seemingly started the day after the election of Trump in 2016, and then the most divisive vote in recent memory. Biden's inaugural speech spoke often of unity and reconciliation, but Democrats and Republicans seem to have been at each other's throats for four consecutive years. How to turn off this mutual animosity may be the most urgent problem Biden faces, but it may also be the most difficult.
47 years of Biden's being in politics, that he would actually be able to do what's necessary to heal the country. Unless, of course, there's some shift in how he sees it, and unless, of course, there's pressure from the left. Like I said, the role of labor, to actually pressure to actually improve the quality of life of working people.
Biden inherits an America which may be at its lowest point in history. America in 2020 combines 1930s economic depression, 1960s cultural division, 1860s concerns with white supremacy, and 1780s questions of political legitimacy. The coronavirus is killing Americans faster than ever. A highly divisive Senate trial of the recently impeached Trump looms. Gun sales and murder records were recently recorded nationwide, and the country remains on high alert for acts of political terrorism, to name a few of the worst problems.
If we're not talking about enacting changes could improve the quality of life immediately, materially, for working people, And I don't think that they'll be able to heal. And I'm talking about, like, Biden is talking about return to normal. Well, what's normal?
Both Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris are considered to be on the right wing of the Democratic Party. Biden's cabinet is filled with holdovers from the era of Barack Obama, during which Biden was the vice president. Kamala Harris has become the highest ranking woman ever in American history. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Ansarullah Political Bureau has issued a statement to condemn the U.S. designation of the movement as a terrorist group. The statement was issued after the measure came into effect on January 19th, the last day of President Donald Trump in the office. In its statement, the movement has underlined the atrocity of the U.S. against the nations resisting its adventurist policies, including Yemen. The statement says the blacklisting of Ansarullah movement reveals that the U.S. plays a key role in Saudi-imposed war against Yemen. It calls the U.S. the major enemy of the Yemeni nation.
The American decision and designation was not surprising to us, as it came at the culmination of the U.S. hostilities against the Yemenis, ongoing on for 6 years by two succeeding American administrations. The American administration is the one who is committing acts of terrorism against the Yemenis. And if it reflects negatively on the Yemeni people, there will certainly be a response determined by the leadership.
The U.S. move has also sparked rage among the Yemeni academics and students who voiced their anger in a protest organized by Sa'a University. The protesters denounced the U.S. policies and its continuing crimes against nations. Who have not bowed to Washington's desires.
The Yemeni people of all groups, especially the academics, stand against this classification and they stand with Ansarullah. The blacklisting will not harm Ansarullah as it did not harm Hezbollah and all other free people in the world. Rather, it may harm ordinary Yemenis only. We reject this decision and refuse to call the Ansarullah movement a terrorist group.
Yemenis are concerned that the U.S. blacklisting of the Ansarullah movement may impact the humanitarian situation in Yemen amid the ongoing war that was launched by the Saudi-led coalition in March 2015. The devastating war has so far killed tens of thousands of civilians and injured thousands of others in Yemen, while displacing millions in the country. Yemenis say the U.S. blacklisting of the Ansarullah movement is an unacceptable move, prompted by the Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. They say the move is aimed at putting more pressure on Yemen, already in dire situation from war and the blockade imposed by the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, sir.
Hi, kiddie. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to his mightiness. So to thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then fail to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, on the last day of the Trump administration, U.S. and the UAE signed a deal with Washington agreeing to sell planes and drones to Abu Dhabi. The UAE will purchase up to 50 F-35 jets, 18 armed drones, and other weapons. Well, the deal is worth $23 billion. The okay from Washington has come after the UAE agreed with the U.S.'s pushing Abu Dhabi to recognize Israel and establish relations with Tel Aviv, which it did. Now, the UAE embassy in Washington, upon announcing the sale, has said that the UAE is committed to de-escalation in the region. We'll take a look at what all of this may mean on this debate. Stay tuned.
Just hours before his term as the 45th U.S. president ended, Donald Trump finalized a controversial arms deal with the United Arab Emirates. The UAE embassy in Washington confirmed signing a $23 billion worth of an arms deal with the U.S. It said Washington has agreed to deliver 50 F-35 jets, 18 armed drones, and other defense equipment. The F-35 jets are a major piece of the weapons deal, which was awarded to Abu Dhabi in return for a normalization deal with Israel. The UAE had long sought the means to purchase F-35 jets, but failed to do so until the Trump administration came into picture. The armed drones purchase is also a significant one. Experts believe it would be the second largest sale of U.S. drones to a single country. The arms deal came despite massive oppositions in and outside the U.S. In December, there were two attempts to block portions of the UAE sale. Both of them failed despite growing calls from anti-war and human rights groups to halt it. Critics of the deal believe that these weapons would likely be used to inflict harm in Libya and Yemen and could further destabilize West Asia. The UAE has been one of the main players of the Saudi-led coalition that waged a years-long war against Yemen. Abu Dhabi is also involved in the Libya conflict, where the absence of a unified government brought several countries in the war zone with the aims of controlling the oil-rich country. It has also supplied weapons to militant groups in Syria. The administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump has been pushing for several arms deals in his final weeks in power. First came the approval of $290 million worth of bombs for Saudi Arabia on December 29. On the same day, the State Department also announced a $4 billion sale of Apache helicopters to Kuwait. There was also a $104 million deal for defense equipment to outfit the plane of Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi and another $65.6 million in precision targeting equipment for Egyptian warplanes. Critics blame Washington for supporting wars and destruction by selling arms to nations that have been destabilizing West Asia. They also warn against the possibility of creating an arms race, which will cause nothing but more deaths and chaos.
I'd like to welcome my guests to this debate, journalist and author Daniel Lazar out of New York, and journalist and political commentator Syed Mohsen Abbas out of London. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off in New York. Daniel, why do you think that this deal was not inked until the last day of Trump's reign?
Well, Trump wanted to slip it in under the wire before Biden took office, sort of present the new administration with a fait accompli, making it harder for Biden to back away from the deal. I don't think Biden will back away from the deal because I think he basically agrees with the logic of Trump's foreign policy, which is to arm the Gulf states against Iran.
Okay, yeah, I was going to ask you if you thought that Biden actually wanted to back away from that deal, but you've answered it. So, Mohsen, initially Israel didn't agree for the UAE to buy the F-35. So you think that was a ploy on its part, or did it later become convinced that it should? Your assessment of that side of things?
I think the assessment has probably changed to some degree. They've decided that they need their erstwhile silent partners, the UAE, the Saudi Arabians, Jordan, all of those buffer Muslim countries, including Egypt as well, amongst that. They've decided that they need them now to act as a physical buffer. And I think that they've initiated that partly with the Saudis' war on Yemen. You can see it there. You can see that the UAE has been commissioned to enter Yemen as well, and they've been also committing atrocities and violating that state's sovereignty. They've also, significantly, the UAE has also been allowed to start building up ports across the region. I think Somalia, Ethiopia, they've been trying to get ports at Socotra, the island just off Yemen. So you can see that there's an expansionism, and the UAE, I think from an Israel point of view, is a sort of major, it's a necessity now. Previously, perhaps they thought by handing over this equipment, it might not be reliable, it could end up in the wrong hands, and they didn't trust them. What's more likely is that the Israeli Defense Force, the American military, are taking hands-on control of all of this this weaponry. Yeah, and it's also a backdoor way of them passing more weaponry to Syrian front and to the Yemeni front as well, I imagine. But the UAE has been a significant purchaser of U.S. military equipment. for obviously years. The latest agreement, defense cooperation agreement, came into force on May the 24th, 2019, and since then the US has been pumping out $28.1 billion in active government to government sales cases with the UAE under foreign military sales systems. So there's a lot of financial activity on the military front that's been going on. And of course, the double whammy is that America, which is economically, of course, troubled as well, is using the Arab states as a cash cow to milk them for sale of military hardware. Of course, this goes into the American economy as well. Israel, I think their purpose is really to bolster up these states as more practical frontline partners for them against what they will see as the axis of resistance threat.
Okay. Well, Daniel, the UAE already spends around $30 billion on its annual military budget. Iran spends around $17 billion annually. Even if Abu Dhabi considers Tehran as an adversary, it already spends almost twice the amount that Iran spends on its military budget. Why do you think that's the case? What does it all mean?
Well, I think that your other guess is correct. And I think that the UAE wants to transform itself into a regional military power, a regional military, economic, and strategic power. It's establishing bases down the Red Sea into the Arabian Sea. It's trying to extend its clout throughout the region, and certainly bolstering its military is one way of doing that. It wants to be a big league player. And the U.S. sees nothing wrong with that. The U.S. rather likes the idea because Saudi Arabia is obviously deeply unstable. So therefore, the U.S. could use a substitute in that region. But I must emphasize that it's all part of a grand orchestrated strategic offensive aimed at isolating Iran and Iran's allies in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon.
Said Mohsen, the UAE embassy in Washington has said that it is committed to de-escalation in the region. Now, it does not appear that the amount of planes and drones that it will be acquiring is going to be used for this de-escalation. Your take on what is said, and actually we see the transaction that is going to be made.
Absolutely right. I mean, we can see from Joe Biden's posturing that he's already now going to review all these contracts and deals, so he says. But that review is, I think, going to be one of going through the motions. And in fact, I think the indication is that they're not happy with the Trump plan to de-escalate what little there was. You know, in Iraq, they were pulling out troops, ostensibly 2,500 troops out of 5,000, officially on record. We don't know the reality. So I don't think Biden has a track record which gives us any hope that he's going to change the Trump policy. In fact, it could be much, much worse. His track record is very much for supporting the beginning of wars, far more likely, some would say, than Donald Trump starting a war with the Islamic Republic or opening up new fronts against the resistance axis. You see, of course, the UAE, Biden will look at this, and during his term in the American administration, he's overseen the Afghanistan and Iraq campaigns, the expeditionary participants, and the UAE is actually in that global coalition, hook, line, and sinker. They co-lead the global coalition's communications working group, for instance, providing what the U.S. State Department says is strong support for counter-messaging and countering violent extremism through its Sawab and Hidayah centers, and also a co-lead of the Coalition Stabilization Working Group. So they're very much at the heart of this. It's all done under the guise that the UAE is helping America fight the war on terror. In fact, the reality is that they are probably part and parcel of the mechanism for the Americans and the Israelis keeping control of that region.
So what you're saying, said Mohsen, basically, if I understand you, is that under a Biden administration, the situation will probably get worse than in the region because, as a matter of fact, de-escalation is going to be the last thing on the agenda. Is that what you're saying?
I think so. I don't think you can see the juggernaut, the industrial military arms complex that the U.S. spearheads needs these wars. They need these conflicts. They rely on them. You know, $7.5 trillion has gone into these wars over the last 20 or 30 years. That's a conservative estimate that we have. We know that they're signing off on more of these contracts. What we're seeing today is the latest of that. But, you know, prior to what the Americans have been trying to sign off here, they've had CH-47F cargo helicopters, terminal high-altitude area defense, the THAAD missiles, as they're known, and also newly refurbished AH-64E helicopters, large aircraft, infrared countermeasures. You know, it goes on these systems. You know, they even have Blackjack unmanned air vehicles, the Patriot sort of Javelin AIM-9X Sidewinder. I could go on. The list of actual really nasty military hardware is endless. And, you know, they've authorized, as I said earlier, permanent export of over $7.2 billion in defense articles to the UAE via their direct commercial sales process. That's an admission by the U.S. State Department. You don't know what's going on the black market, of course. Right. Whatever's going on the side, it's a different story.
Well, Daniel, as you said earlier, and also said Mohsen, that basically what Washington is doing is trying to threaten Iran. So I want to look at that side of things. In a new Biden administration, do you think that this is the line that's going to be continued, that they want to create more pressure against Iran? Or do you see a possibility of the Biden administration going in a different direction?
I believe it's the former. I think that the Biden administration will maintain as hard a line against Iran as the Trump administration, if not even harder. I mean, it's determined to do the bidding of Israel as much as Trump did, and Israel has just one priority. It sees Iran as its strategic enemy, the most dangerous force in the middle in the entire region. It wants Iran beaten back. Even, you know, to the point of imposing regime change. The U.S. has happily joined in that, you know, in that viewpoint, and I don't see Biden really differing from that at all.
Mm-hmm.
Even Biden's rhetoric about the JCPOA. I mean, Biden has made it clear that he will only re-enter the JCPOA if he's able to gain further concessions from Iran regarding its support for the Syrian government, Hezbollah, Shiite forces in Iraq, and of course the Houthis in Yemen. So Biden is determined to increase the diplomatic pressure on Iran over what Trump had already imposed.
Do you see, staying with what you've just said, do you see this new administration more or less pro-Zionist than the previous administration?
At least as much as the previous administration, if not more so. The alliance between the U.S. and Israel gets closer and closer. And that means that the U.S. adopts Israel's most militant attitudes vis-a-vis Iran. So I just don't see any hope for any kind of, you know, realignment in the Persian Gulf. I just see an ever tougher stance on the part of the U.S.
Well, Said Mohsen, some experts say that Abu Dhabi sold out its Palestinian brethren for basically $23 billion worth of military equipment and accepted to normalize relations with Israel. Your take on that assessment, and overall, what does it mean? Not only, of course, we saw that with the UAE, but we also saw it with Sudan and Saudi Arabia and Bahrain.
Well, of course, the American policy in the Middle East is primarily, obviously, for raping oil and resources of that region. Secondly, to maintain dictators and leaders who basically don't give individual sovereignty to the nations, but rather support the interests of Israel and America. That's been going on for decades. And finally, of course, as we said, the cash cow business of taking arms sales is now the more obvious one. So, look, the thing is, I think that the bottom line is that the UAE and this normalization process was part of really that entire overall American American and Israeli joint policy in the region. It's just now that they really called in their, if you like, their erstwhile silent partners to come into openly normalizing. And what the UAE is doing is essentially putting all of its eggs in the basket of the Zio-American imperialist powers in that region. And, of course, it is on the borders of Iran, well, on the sea borders, at least. And that poses, a huge threat for Iran. It also poses a problem for the UAE, because if the saber-rattling that goes on between Israel and Iran, or America and Iran, continues, and somebody, you know, decides to take a rash move, of course, these bases in the UAE are some of the bases which will launch any possible attacks on Iran. And Iran and the establishment has already made it very, very clear several times. The administration has made it clear that the allies of Israel, those who are normalizing Israel's apartheid in Palestine, those who are supporting terrorist organizations across the Middle East, those who are undermining the independence and integrity of the people of the region, the ordinary citizens, are on their target list as well. And if anything happens to Tehran, or anything happens to the major nerve centers of certainly the Islamic Republic, the UAE, Abu Dhabi, etc., will all be number one on the hit list. And Tel Aviv, of course, it has also been warned. So it is a really fragile situation, and the world really needs to take note. There's an ambivalence in America. There's an ambivalence across the world stage in this Cold War, or this hot war, which has actually been played out as well simultaneously. But the world is going to ill afford to ignore this for very much longer, because it only takes a little mistake, a little calculation to go wrong. Right. And what we can see happen with the case of General Soleimani, and the tolerance and the patience that the Islamic Republic employed by only attacking one or two American sites, could run out, and they may be forced to go further. The military exercises in the Gulf, the American B-52s that have been flying to and from, these military sales to the UAE, all of this is the drums of war,
okay.
Something which I think the whole international community has to step in and to de-escalate.
Daniel, your assessment of it all, you just heard Syed Mohsen talk about, it only takes a spark to basically light up the whole area. With this situation, we see the increase of weapons that being sold by Washington or London to these regional countries. Your assessment of the possibility of even further destabilization?
Well, it's very hard to predict, but I think in the long run, we can safely say that the likelihood is steadily rising. I mean, the U.S. is assembling its anti-Iranian coalition. It is stuffing the region filled with arms, ever more so. The area is bristling with weaponry, and it just takes a spark to set off the conflagration. And we don't know what will happen. It didn't happen after the assassination of Soleimani. Didn't happen after the assassination of the Iranian nuclear scientist. But the next incident could. It's so hard to predict, but the general trend seems clear. The situation is growing more and more dangerous.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with us on this debate. Journalist and author Daniel Lazar out of New York, and journalist and political commentator Syed Mohsen Abbas out of London. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Thanks so much for being with us.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
onto our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
The Justice Department's top leaders listened in stunned silence this month. One of their peers, they were told, had devised a plan with former President Donald J. Trump to oust Jeffrey A. Rosen as acting Attorney General and wield the department's power to force Georgia state lawmakers to overturn its presidential election results. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Katie Benner and Maggie Haberman. The piece is titled, Trump and Justice Department Lawyers Said to Have Plotted to Oust Acting Attorney General. Justice Department's top leaders listened in stunned silence this month. One of their peers, they were told, had devised a plan with President Donald J. Trump to oust Jeffrey A. Rosen as acting Attorney General and wield the department's power to force Georgia state lawmakers to overturn its presidential election results. The unassuming lawyer who worked on the plan, Jeffrey Clark, had been devising ways to cast doubt on the election results and to bolster Donald Trump's continuing legal battles and the pressure on Georgia politicians. Because Mr. Rosen had refused the president's entreaties to carry out those plans, Donald Trump was about to decide whether to fire Mr. Rosen and replace him with Mr. Clark. The department officials convened on a conference call, then asked each other, "What will you do if Mr. Rosen is dismissed?" The answer was unanimous. They would all resign. Their informal pact ultimately helped persuade Donald Trump to keep Mr. Rosen in place, calculating that a furore over mass resignations at the top of the Justice Department would eclipse any attention on his baseless accusations of voter fraud. Donald Trump's decision came only after Mr. Rosen and Mr. Clark made their competing cases to him in a bizarre White House meeting that two officials compared with an episode of Donald Trump's reality show, The Apprentice, albeit one that could prompt a constitutional crisis. The previously unknown chapter was the culmination of the president's long-running effort to batter the Justice Department into advancing his personal agenda. He also pressed Mr. Rosen to appoint special counsels, including one who would look into Dominion voting systems, a maker of election equipment that Donald Trump's allies had falsely said was working with Venezuela to flip votes from Mr. Trump to Joseph R. Biden Jr. This account of the department's final days under Donald Trump's leadership is based on interviews with four former Trump administration officials, who all asked not to be named because of fear of retaliation. Jeffrey Clark said that this account contained inaccuracies, but did not specify, adding that he could not discuss any conversations with Donald Trump or Justice Department lawyers because of the strictures of legal privilege. Senior Justice Department lawyers, not uncommonly, provide legal advice to the White House as part of our duties, he said. All my official communications were consistent with law. Mr. Clark categorically denied that he devised any plan to oust Mr. Rosen or to formulate recommendations for action based on factual inaccuracies gleaned from the internet. My practice is to rely on sworn testimonies to assess disputed factual claims, Mr. Clark said. There was a candid discussion of options and pros and cons with the president. It is unfortunate that those who were part of a privileged legal conversation would comment on public about such internal deliberations, while also distorting any discussions. Mr. Clark also noted that he was the lead signatory on a Justice Department request last month, asking a federal judge to reject a lawsuit that sought to pressure Vice President Mike Pence to overturn the results of the election. Donald Trump declined to comment. An advisor said that Mr. Trump has consistently argued that the Justice Department should investigate rampant election fraud that has plagued our system for years. The advisor added that any assertion to the contrary is false and being driven by those who wish to keep the system broken. Mr. Clark agreed and said that legal privileges prevented him from divulging specifics regarding the conversation. A Justice Department spokesman declined to comment, as did Mr. Rosen. When Donald Trump said on 14th of December that Attorney General William Barr was leaving the department, some officials thought that he might allow Mr. Rosen a short reprieve before pressing him about voter fraud. After all, William Barr would be around for another week. Instead, Donald Trump summoned Mr. Rosen to the Oval Office just the next day. He wanted the Justice Department to file legal briefs supporting his allies' lawsuits seeking to overturn his election loss. And he urged Mr. Rosen to appoint special counsels to investigate not only unfounded accusations of widespread voter fraud, but also Dominion, the voting machines firm. Dominion has sued the pro-Trump lawyer, Sidney Powell, who inserted those accusations into four federal lawsuits about voter irregularities that were all dismissed by courts of law. Mr. Rosen refused. He maintained that he would make decisions based on the facts and the law, and he reiterated what William Barr had privately told Donald Trump. The Department of Justice had investigated voting irregularities and found no evidence whatsoever of widespread fraud. But Mr. Trump continued to press Mr. Rosen after the meeting, in phone calls and in person. He repeatedly said that he did not understand why the Justice Department had not found evidence that supported conspiracy theories about the election and some of his personal lawyers had espoused. He declared that the Department of Justice was not fighting hard enough for him. As Mr. Rosen and the Deputy Attorney General, Richard P. Donohue, pushed back, they were unaware that Mr. Clark had been introduced to Donald Trump by a Pennsylvania politician and had told the president that he agreed that fraud had affected the election results. Donald Trump quickly embraced Jeffrey Clark, who had been appointed the acting head of the Civil Division in September and was also the head of the department's Environmental and Natural Resources Division. As December wore on, Mr. Clark mentioned to Mr. Rosen and Mr. Donohue that he spent a lot of time reading on the internet, a comment that alarmed them because they inferred that he believed the unfounded conspiracy theory that Donald Trump had won the election. Jeffrey Clark also told them that he wanted the department to hold a news conference announcing that it was investigating serious accusations of election fraud. Mr. Rosen and Mr. Donohue rejected the proposal. As Donald Trump focused increasingly on Georgia, a state he lost narrowly to Joe Biden, he complained to Justice Department leaders and the U.S. Attorney in Atlanta, Byung J. Pak, was not trying to find evidence for false election claims pushed by Mr. Trump's lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani, and others. Mr. Donohue warned Mr. Pak that the president was now fixated on his office, and that it might not be tenable for him to continue to lead it according to two people familiar with the conversation. That conversation and Donald Trump's effort to pressure Georgia's Republican Secretary of State to find him votes eventually compared Byung J. Pak to abruptly resign this month. Mr. Clark was also focused on Georgia. He drafted a letter that he wanted Mr. Rosen to send to Georgia state legislatures that wrongly said that the Justice Department was investigating accusations of voter fraud in their state and that they should move to avoid Mr. Biden's win there. Mr. Rosen and Mr. Donohue again rejected Mr. Clark's proposal. On New Year's Eve, the trio met to discuss Mr. Clark's refusal to hew to the department's conclusion that the election results were valid. Mr. Donohue flatly told Mr. Clark that what he was doing was wrong. The next day, Mr. Clark told Mr. Rosen, who had mentored him whilst they worked together at the law firm Kirkland & Ellis, that he was going to discuss this strategy with the president early the next week, just before Congress was set to certify Joe Biden's electoral victory. Unbeknown to the acting attorney general, Mr. Clark's timeline moved up. He met with Donald Trump over the weekend, then informed Mr. Rosen midday on Sunday that the president intended to replace him with Mr. Clark, who could then try to stop Congress from certifying the Electoral College results. He said that Mr. Rosen could stay on as his deputy attorney general, leaving Mr. Rosen speechless. Unwilling to step down without a fight, Mr. Rosen said that he needed to hear straight from the president himself, Donald Trump, and work with the White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, to convene a meeting for early that evening. Even as Mr. Clark's pronouncement was sinking in, stunning news broke out of Georgia. State officials had recorded an hour-long conversation published by the Washington Post, during which Donald Trump pressured them to manufacture enough votes to declare him the victor. As the fallout from the recording ricocheted through Washington, the president's desperate bid to change the outcome in Georgia came into sharp focus. Mr. Rosen and Mr. Donohue pressed ahead, informing Stephen Engel, the head of the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, about Mr. Clark's latest maneuver. Mr. Donohue convened a late afternoon call with the department's remaining senior leaders, laying out Mr. Clark's effort to replace the Attorney General, Mr. Rosen. The Attorney General, Mr. Rosen, planned to soon head to the White House to discuss his fate, Mr. Donohue told the group. Should Mr. Rosen be fired, they all agreed to resign en masse. For some, the plan brought to mind the so-called Saturday Night Massacre of the Richard Nixon era, where Attorney General at the time, Elliot Richardson, and his deputy resigned rather than carry out the president's order to fire the special prosecutor investigating him. The Clark plan, the officials concluded, would seriously harm the department, the government, and the rule of law. For hours, they anxiously messaged and called one another as they awaited Mr. Rosen's fate. Around 6 p.m., Mr. Rosen and Mr. Donohue and Mr. Clark met at the White House with Donald Trump, Pat Cipollone and his deputy, Patrick Philbin, and other lawyers. Donald Trump had Mr. Rosen and Mr. Clark present their arguments to him. Pat Cipollone advised the president not to fire Mr. Rosen, and he reiterated, as he had for days, that he did not recommend sending the letter to Georgia lawmakers. Mr. Engel advised Donald Trump that he and the department's remaining top officials would all resign if he fired Mr. Rosen, leaving Mr. Clark alone at the Department of Justice. Donald Trump seemed somewhat swayed by the idea that firing Mr. Rosen would trigger not only chaos at the Justice Department, but also congressional investigations and possibly recriminations from other Republicans, and distract attention from his efforts to overturn the election results. After nearly 3 hours at the meeting at the White House, Donald Trump ultimately decided that Mr. Clark's plan would fail, and he allowed Mr. Rosen to stay on as Attorney General.
Good morning.
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.